two good friends from high school who hadn't seen each other for years sat down at lunch one day, and they had a lot of catching up to do. Juanita said, "You're not going to believe this, but 10 years ago, I got married." "Oh, that's good," her friend said. "But I must say, he's a rather homely man." "Oh, that's bad," her friend said. "But," Juanita said, "he is a multimillionaire." "Oh, that's good," her friend says. "But," Juanita says, "he's a very stingy millionaire." "Oh, that's too bad. But in his stinginess, he did manage to build me a palatial mansion." "Oh, that's good," her friend says. "But then the mansion burned down." "Oh, that's bad. And when it burned down, he was in it." Her friend wasn't sure what to say at this point. Is it good or is it bad? Life is often like that, right? Something happens and we're not sure. Is it good or is it bad? Should I laugh or cry? Should I celebrate or mourn? The Palm Sunday story in the Bible has often struck me as being like that. On the one hand, multitudes of people recognized Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah and embraced him. That's good. On the other hand, as Jesus triumphantly entered Jerusalem, he set in motion a series of events that were going to lead directly to his death. That's bad. Or is it? The Palm Sunday story is a classic example of what we would call something that is bittersweet. So, what does God want to say to us through this bittersweet story? As I've meditated on that, three things grab my attention. Three things that I think God wants to say to us today through this bittersweet Bible story. Let's say a prayer and then we'll dive in. God, we are so grateful for Jesus. Jesus, thank you for the power of your life and your example. Thank you for all that we can learn from what you experienced. Thank you for becoming one of us so that you could show us the way, the truth, and the life. Thank you that you were even willing to die so that we can live. May we not waste even 1 ounce of the truth that you came to reveal to us. Help us to soak it in today. We ask in your holy name. Amen. Luke chapter 19, verses 29 through 34. Jesus sent two of his disciples saying, "Go into the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find tied there a colt that has never been ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' just say, 'The Lord needs it.' So those who were sent departed and found it as Jesus had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' They said, 'The Lord needs it.' And they brought it to Jesus." At first blush, these verses that I just reread to you seem to be a rather incidental and unimportant part of the biblical Palm story. Luke wastes 6 whole Bible verses telling us the intricate details of how Jesus managed to procure a donkey to ride into Jerusalem. Come on, Luke, get on to the good parts of the story. Why are you wasting our time with all of these details about a donkey? Answer: because sometimes The details really matter. And boy, is that true in this case. If the Spirit of God inspired Luke to spend six whole verses on these details, there must be something there that we are meant to get from it. Basically, in this first part of the story, Jesus tells two of his disciples to go into a certain village, that there they will come across a young donkey colt that has never been ridden before. Grab that donkey and bring it to me. Jesus said, if somebody asks you, what are you doing? Just say, God needs it. Try that the next time you're in the grocery store line and you decide to shoplift a Mars bar and the clerk at the grocery store says, what are you doing? Just say, God needs it. And see how that works for you. But in this story, it works. The two disciples manage to stumble across the only owners of a donkey probably on the face of the globe who, when they heard God needs it, were either gullible enough or faith-filled enough to say, okay, you can have it. So, to recap, the disciples go into a village. They find a young donkey never ridden on before. They nab it. The owners say, what are you doing? They say, God needs it. And they're delighted to let them take it. What are the odds that the right person with just the right kind of donkey just happened to be in just the right place at just the right time? It's odd. There's an old saying that goes like this: it's not odd, it's God. And that's the first key point I see in this story. I think this is one of the key points the Spirit is trying to get across to us as we enter into the Palm Sunday story. There are no accidents. As you journey through life, wherever you happen to find yourself at any given moment in time, it is no accident, because God is everywhere, by which I mean God is active in every situation, even in tragedies that God did not want to happen, even in situations where you say, I don't know if this is good or if this is bad. God is present in that situation, trying to draw out of it some good, some redeeming value, some positive opportunity. It's the dance of life. You make a move, God makes a move. Somebody else makes a move, God makes another move. So on and so forth, back and forth it goes. It's the sacred dance of life. Even when somebody screws up, God doesn't give up. God just makes another move. The sacred dance of life. The dance between God's providence and human free will. People of faith live with that expectation. Around any corner, I just may encounter God. A couple weeks ago now, Carl Scott sent me an email sharing a story. Many of you know Carl. He's a member of our congregation. His dad died back in December. Since then, he and his extended family have been working to clear out his dad's house. First, of course, they all passed through the house, and each one decided what items they wanted that were of sentimental value to them. But Carl says after we had gone through everything and everybody had taken what they wanted, there were still tons of furniture and many other things that were left in Dad's house. He said he and his family had chatted a great deal about what charity did they now want to call to come in and take the rest of this stuff away as a donation. But for some reason, he said, we kept procrastinating. We just couldn't reach a decision. Then he said, two Saturdays ago, he, his brother, and his sister were in the house looking things over when Carl got an idea. He thought, I know, he said to his brother and sister, we should put a sign out front at the road saying, free furniture. Now, they knew this was kind of a long shot because his dad lived on a not very well-traveled road, but what did they have to lose? So they put a sign out at the road, free furniture. Carl says, not less than 5 minutes later, a couple stopped. They wanted to see the furniture. As they did so, they started to tell their story to Carl. Their house had recently burned down and they lost everything. They were now renting a house a couple miles up the road, but they had nothing in it. They were desperate for how they were going to set up house again. So they walked through Carl's dad's house. Carl says they ended up taking all of the furniture and much of the other stuff. The very last sentence in Carl's email to me said, "I don't believe this was a coincidence." And that's the point. It was meant to be. In exquisite detail. It was not an accident. We live in a world that is alive with God's presence. Live with that expectation. Live with that alertness in your soul. Live with that lively spiritual expectation. It is our first key lesson from the Palm Sunday story today. There are no accidents. God is active in every situation. Be alert. In September of 1862, the Civil War had reached a pivotal juncture. The Union Army of the Potomac had suffered a string of stunning losses. General Lee, the leader of the Confederate forces, had concluded that the Union Army was, quote, much weakened and dispirited. So he decided to strike while the iron was hot and see if he could break this wide open. So he led Confederate troops north into Maryland. As the Union Army repositioned its troops in response, it just so happens that the Indiana 27th Regiment of the Union Army of the Potomac was ordered to march to Frederick, Maryland. As they approached the outskirts of Frederick, the 27th Regiment decided to take a break in a field outside of Frederick. As they were sitting there in the field resting, one of them, Corporal Barton Mitchell, happened to notice a makeshift envelope that had been dropped in the middle of the field in the tall grass. Curious, he opened it up and was stunned to find what would prove to be one of seven handmade copies of General Lee's battle plan for Maryland. Now think about it. Somebody who had been entrusted with this extraordinarily confidential document just happened to drop it in the middle of a field. And then the 27th Regiment just happened to decide to take a break in that field. And Corporal Barton just happened to notice the envelope and open it up. And the information in it was critical. It allowed the Union forces, against the odds, to win the Battle of Antietam. In his book, Crossroads of Freedom, Antietam, James McPherson puts it this way, quote, "The odds against the occurrence of such a chain of events must have been a million to one. Yet they happened. And because they did, the course of the war and the structure of American society were changed unalterably. As a member of Lee's staff at Antietam later remarked, the loss of these battle plans constitutes one of the pivots on which the war turned." But the story doesn't stop there. 5 days after the Battle of Antietam, Abraham Lincoln stands before his cabinet and tells them that prior to the Battle of Antietam, quote, "I made a promise to myself and to my Maker that if God gave us the victory in the approaching battle, I would consider it an indication of divine will in favor of emancipation." He went on to tell his cabinet that he believed Antietam was a sign that, quote, God had decided this question in favor of the slaves. And so that day, he gave an order that set in motion a series of events that led directly to the Emancipation Proclamation. So put it all together now. An act that would change the course of American history and change the fabric of our nation forever begins with somebody who just happens to drop a highly confidential document in the middle of a field. The 27th Regiment happens to stop there. Corporal Barton happens to find it. It just so happens that the president, before the Battle of Antietam, had promised God that if we win this battle, I'll take that as a sign from you that I should issue, that I should emancipate the slaves. And it happened just that way. What are the odds? It's odd. It's not odd. It's God. We live in a world that is alive with the presence of God. Keep your eyes open. The places you go, the people you meet, the things that happen are no accident. There are no accidents. God is at work in every situation. This is our first key lesson from the palm story. I'm glad Luke didn't leave those details out. But now, once Jesus had procured the donkey, he got up on the donkey and started riding down the path that leads from the Mount of Olives into Jerusalem, when all of a sudden, jubilant celebration breaks out. Pilgrims who were gathering in Jerusalem to celebrate the festival of the Passover began to recognize who it was that was riding this donkey. Look, it's Jesus. Look, it's the wonder worker. It's the miracle worker. And before long, as Chris said in the family moment, they were throwing down their cloaks, a red carpet welcome. They were waving their palm branches. They were shouting. They were singing, welcoming Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah. Luke 19:37. They were praising God joyfully with a loud voice for all the deeds of power they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, order your disciples to stop." He answered, "I tell you, if these were to be silent, the very stones would shout out." Now, mind you, Jesus knew exactly where all of this was leading. Before he and his disciples ever even left for this trip to Jerusalem, he had forewarned his disciples that this trip to Jerusalem would result in his death. He knew what was coming. Imagine how bittersweet it must have been as he was riding into Jerusalem with all of these people welcoming him as the long-awaited Messiah. If I had been Jesus in that situation, I probably would have said, "Everybody be quiet. I don't feel like celebrating. Don't you see where this is headed? The end is near. The future is grim. So let's just walk into the city in solemn silence." But not Jesus. He let them celebrate. He encouraged them to celebrate. He refused to command them to stop celebrating, even in the face of impending tragedy. And therein lies our second key lesson. Celebrate. Life is going to be full of ups and downs, but don't let that stop you from celebrating. The future is bound to hold significant pain in one form or another for every one of us. But leave the future to God. Live in the present moment. Live in the day and make the most of it. Seize your chances to celebrate. This is a day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. That's what Jesus was doing on this Palm Sunday. He knew the days ahead were going to be turbulent in the extreme, but he was modeling for us what it looks like to live in the moment, live in the day, celebrate the day. Especially those of us who tend to be a bit pensive, like me, really need this important reminder. Nancy Walker was good buddies with her neighbor's five-year-old son, Jimmy Yagan. So when Jimmy's pet goldfish died, he asked Nancy to be part of the funeral. Jimmy created a makeshift tombstone, but since he was 5 years old and didn't write very well yet, he asked Nancy if she would do the honors of inscribing the tombstone. "All right," she said. "What do you want me to say?" He said, "Say that his name was Mobert." So she dutifully inscribed his name on the cardboard tombstone. "Okay," she said, "do you want to say anything else?" He thought for a second, then said, "Put down, he was fun while he lasted." I like that. What an epitaph, right? When it comes my time, when it comes your time, will they be able to say that about us? Life is short. There are going to be lots of ups and downs in life. Let's have fun while it lasts. And believe you me, I'm preaching to myself as much as anybody else because I tend to be overly serious about things, but this is such a critical lesson in life. Life is a gift from God, and God wants us to celebrate that gift in good times and in bad times. Last Sunday, I told you about how in 2011, my brother-in-law, Bobby, passed away of ALS after a 10-year struggle with ALS. In fact, some of you would gather here at the altar with me and my sister and Bobby, and we prayed for him on a number of occasions as they would pass through town. But in 2011, he succumbed to his ALS. About 5 years into that experience of ALS, his son got married in a beautiful chapel at Tennessee Temple University in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I had the honors of officiating at that ceremony. After the ceremony, we all gathered in a ballroom on the top floor of a hotel there in Chattanooga where everybody was staying, a big reception, a celebration. There was a dinner, there was a live band. People began to dance on the dance floor. Not me, of course, because I grew up Baptist, and though I think dancing is perfectly wonderful and fine, I've never been able to quite lose that Baptist uptightness about dancing. And so, as you may notice, like that song that had such a good rhythm earlier in the worship service, and I was kind of doing this, that's about the maximum output I can generate for dancing, right? Anything more than that would be very dangerous. I'm very self-conscious about dancing. In any event, as the dancing was taking place, I looked out on the dance floor at one point, and Bobby was cutting a rug. Now, mind you, he was 5 years into ALS, often rode in a wheelchair. He could get up and move around a bit, but his right side was weak. He couldn't stand up straight at this point. But there he was, out there on the dance floor. His dancing was awkward, but he wasn't holding back. He was celebrating the wedding of his only son like he didn't have a care in the world.
If it had been me in his shoes, I would have been pensively thinking, what's going to happen to me? How much longer do I have? If it had been me in his shoes, I would have been too self-conscious to dance so awkwardly and obviously disabledly. But not him. He was celebrating with his whole heart, and I stood there in awe, realizing that Bobby wasn't the one who was disabled, I was. His body was compromised, but his soul was full and robust. Like Jesus before him, he was celebrating with his whole heart, even in the face of fierce adversity. Brothers and sisters, don't wait until everything's hunky-dory in life to celebrate, because that day will never come. There are constantly going to be ups and downs in life. God wants us, like Jesus and his disciples, to embrace the gift of life, to embrace the day, to find ways to celebrate even in the midst of difficult or turbulent times, just like Jesus modeled for us in the palm story. All of which then brings us finally to our third and final lesson, the last part of the story. Luke chapter 19, verse 41. As Jesus came near to Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it. So a moment earlier, he and everyone else had been rejoicing. But as he rounds the bend and sees God's city, he begins to weep. Wait a minute. I thought earlier the story had told us that multitudes, thousands of Jesus' contemporaries had just welcomed him and embraced him as the long-awaited Messiah and the coming king. So why was Jesus so sad for the city? Remember, even though thousands upon thousands welcomed Jesus as Messiah that day, they were still just a tiny fraction of the total population. Historians tell us that in that time, in that culture, for the festival of the Passover, the population of Jerusalem would have swollen to at least 250,000 people, if not many times more. So let's say 20,000 people welcomed Jesus that day as the long-awaited Messiah and escorted him into Jerusalem. That would still be much less than 10% of the total population. So think about it. Here was someone who'd given his people multiple signs that he was the one they had been waiting for. He had healed the sick. He had given sight to the blind. He had cast out demons. He had raised the dead. This was Israel's great moment. This was the moment that Jesus' people had been awaiting for centuries. This was their time. And 90%+ of the people yawned and went on with their day, as if nothing was happening. Jesus said, if you, even you, Jerusalem, had only recognized on this day the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. Indeed, the days will come when your enemies will set up ramparts around you and surround you and hem you in on every side. They will crush you because you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God. They missed their God moment. In less than 40 years, the Romans would surround the city of Jerusalem, lay siege to it, and utterly wipe it out. They missed their God moment. The lesson for us is pretty obvious. Our choices have enormous consequences. Don't miss your God moments. Take a look at at this photograph that I'm about to show you and see if you can figure out what is happening here. Can you see that? It's a group of teenagers, the boys in the back, the girls in the front, sitting on a bench in a museum. And they are, each one of them, to a person, intently looking at their phones. Did I get a message? Should I send a text? All the while, do you see what's behind them on the wall? It's one of the greatest works of art in the history of the world. There's a Rembrandt, the Night Caller, on the wall behind them. This is their moment to gaze at one of the greatest works of art in the history of humanity, and they're completely oblivious to it. These teenagers are a metaphor for us. They remind us that we often get so preoccupied that we miss the big picture, that we fail to see what the master artist is trying to do in the world and trying to do in our lives. Look up. Look up. Back in 1876, an internal memo began circulating at Western Union. Western Union, back in the 1800s, was one of the mammoth communications companies, a telegraph company. But a newfangled device called the telephone had recently been invented. And so an internal memo circulated at Western Union evaluating what they should do about the telephone. The memo put it this way: the, quote, telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us. Think of what could have been for Western Union. But they missed their moment. In 1903, the president of the Michigan Savings Bank advised the lawyer to Henry Ford that he should not invest in the Ford Motor Company because, quote, the horse is here to stay, but the automobile is only a novelty, a fad. And they missed their moment. In 1962, Decca Recording Company auditioned a new band called the Beatles and refused to sign them because we don't like their sound and guitar music is on the way out. And they missed their moment. Our choices have enormous consequences. Let me close with this. One of my top five all-time movies is Dead Poets Society, because I like movies that make you think. That movie tells the story of a professor, Professor Keating, an eccentric professor who's hired on at a traditional, uptight New England prep school. Keating is an eccentric nonconformist in the 1950s era of conformity. And so this English lit teacher begins to try to inspire his students at this prep school to dare to break the mold, to follow their passion, to follow their dreams. He wants them to be open to seeing different perspectives on any given situation. So one day in class, to drive home this point, he insists that all of them take turns coming up to the front of the classroom and standing up on top of his desk and looking out at the room because he wants them to see how different the room looks from that vantage point than from their seats. He uses Walt Whitman's famous poem about Lincoln as an example of what can happen when somebody breaks the mold. He encourages his students to refer to him, Keating, as, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." He's a weird guy. Crazy. But the students start to get it. They start to embrace his message. Keating in this movie is a Jesus-like figure that is calling his disciples to dare to break the mold. But as things progress, one of Keating's students decides his dream is to be an actor, but that student's father says, "Over my dead body, you're going to do something traditional. You're going to do something reliable. You're going to do something that's bound to make you as wealthy as I am. The student commits suicide. The headmaster of the school sees this as his opportunity to get rid of this eccentric professor. He pressures the students to sign a document implicating Keating in the suicide of this student. He fires Keating. The next day, the headmaster is in the English lit class leading a dry lecture. The students are sitting there. A heavy pall has settled over them. They lost one of their classmates to suicide. They lost their beloved professor, who's now been fired. As the headmaster is giving a dry lecture, he asks them to turn to a certain page in their English lit books and asks the student to read from that page. The student says, "I can." The headmaster says, "Why?" The student says, "Because Professor Keating told us to tear that page out. It was nonsense." The headmaster is enormously annoyed. Just then, Keating starts to walk into the room, not realizing class is in session. He's coming back to retrieve his things. He stops. There's this awkward moment where the students are now face to face with this beloved professor, each of them knowing that they had signed this document under pressure that had implicated him. One of the shyest of the students, Todd, speaks up and says, "They made us sign it, Mr. Keating. You've got to believe it. It's true." "I believe you, Todd," Keating says. The headmaster orders him out. "Any more outbursts," the headmaster says, "and you'll be out of here, Todd, and anybody else that has an outburst, you'll be out of this school. Get out, Keating." You can see it on Todd's face. What's he going to do? Is he going to be quiet and conform? Or is he going to follow his heart? This is his moment. He jumps up out of his seat, jumps up on his desk, and says to Keating, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." The headmaster is yelling at him. But one by one, the other students, inspired by Todd, start to do the same, until they're all up on top of their desks. "Oh, Captain, my Captain," pledging their allegiance to this one who had awakened life in them. It was their moment. They met their moment. They made their choice. How about us? Jesus is calling. Imagine what could have been if 90% of Jesus' contemporaries had embraced him as Messiah. Imagine what could happen in our lives and in our world if we did the same. Our choices have consequences. Don't miss your moments. Where in your life today is the Spirit of Christ stirring inside of you and calling you to do something courageous? Don't miss your moment.